Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for you, as usual. And we've got three pretty good ones here as we close out the week. Jim, one of the big stories all this week has been the discovery of this email, thanks to the Freedom of Information request from Judicial Watch, from White House official Ben Rhodes, as part of the talking points in preparing Susan Rice for her appearance on the five Sunday talk shows about Benghazi back in September of 2012. And one of the big issues, of course, was how the White House got this narrative of blaming everything on this YouTube video that was insulting to Islam. And, well, the White House has been trying to say that this email is not just in reference to Benghazi. It's in reference to all the unrest that was going on in the region back at that time, in Cairo the same day, Yemen, Tunisia, and all this stuff. Because of how this document got released, specifically with respect to a request on Benghazi documents and the contents of the email itself, even the mainstream media folks now are saying that they're just not buying this explanation. Here's a couple of quick comments, one from Jake Tapper of CNN on the Hugh Hewitt Show, and then John King on CNN itself.
The comments that are being made are dissembling, obfuscating, and often, you know, insulting. So, I mean, I don't disagree with those who don't care for what's going on at the press conferences.
I don't know how you can say this is not about Benghazi.
Now,
if you look at the timeline of events, I can't understand why the White House did this.
King basically going on there to say that if this email had been released right away, they could have had a more plausible explanation that they were still going on faulty initial information at the time and there was no intentional deception on their part. So, Jim, obviously there's a lot of layers to this. We'll talk about it again in a different dimension in the third martini. But the fact that the mainstream media, A, is covering this, at least most of them, and showing this much skepticism means we might actually get somewhere, hopefully.
It is. And what makes this week's whole coverage really the good martini is it wasn't that long ago that even a very wise voice like Charles Krauthammer was saying, really, the window of opportunity for discussion and figuring out what the getting answers in Benghazi had passed. The public had largely moved on. All the investigations on Capitol Hill seemed to stall. And that's, you know, this is not, you know, left-wing maniac Charles Krauthammer, you know, trying to spin for the administration. I think it was his honest assessment of where things stood and feeling like the public had been bothered by this by a while, but moved on and didn't really have much interest or appetite for further investigation of this. But now we know there's more to learn. And what's more is that, you know, every explanation they have put out has subsequently been found false. And so I'm on the one hand, it's really glad to see Tapper saying that. It's really glad to see John King saying that. The only little gripe in those comments there is it seems like a little bit of a failure of the moral imagination, you might say, on the part of John King, because I can't imagine why the administration would do this. Well, let's think here. You know, I mean, that basically they had really terrible news 2 months before Election Day. And, you know, right there explicitly in this email is kind of what I think is, you know, it's not just a smoking gun, but I think that one of the key phrases is that not a failure of administration policy. You know, the subtext there is don't blame us. It's not our fault. There's nothing we could have done and there's nothing no way we could have foreseen this. At the very time, I was like, wait a minute, it's September 11th. You know, this is most Americans are never going to look at that date on the calendar the same ever again. How could people in charge of embassy security not grasp the potential danger there? And then the more they talk about, a demonstration over a video, but then we're saying, well, there's rocket launchers and stuff. This doesn't, you know, this wasn't a demonstration. You know, there's a shooting of artillery and things like this at our guys. That's not a protest. So from the very beginning, the explanation didn't quite make sense. So why did the administration pursue this course? They wanted the explanation that had them as least culpable as possible. And everything we've figured out since then, particularly about the State Department turning down Stevens' request for additional security, the continued confusion, including yesterday's statement from one of the military intelligence folks on the ground in Africa saying, look, we were waiting for a request from assistance from the State Department. Well, then why didn't the State Department make that request? What was going on over there? What was the delay? You keep hearing people saying, well, they knew they wouldn't get there in time. How the heck do you know? Does this firefight have a timetable? Is there a schedule that we know it's going to be over by a certain time? Every explanation that comes out from the administration never really makes much sense. And if you think about it for more than a minute, So there's a lot more to learn here. It's glad to see King and Tapper, and maybe hopefully some of their colleagues will be picking up that there's need for additional digging, there's need for additional coverage. And what's really clear here is that the administration no longer gets the benefit of the doubt on this. And that, you know, once you put that to the tone to your coverage, everything changes a great deal.
It certainly does. And now that one of the tests will be, especially for those who have already spoken up, will they keep on this? You know, in many different scandals, especially ones that affect the right, it's just a constant daily drumbeat on the front page of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and a lot of the mainstream media outlets. Is this going to be a 1 or 2 day story? And then it dissipates when something else happens to draw everyone's attention away from it. Or will there be persistent coverage as long as the proper committees are investigating this sort of thing? So that'll be a big test for the media as well. On to martini number two now, Jim, and it is the first Friday of the month, and that means the Labor Department has released the job numbers for the month prior. And there is some good news here. 288,000 jobs were added in the month of April. That is well above most of the months we've seen any time recently. So that is good news. The overall unemployment rate dropping from 6.7 to 6.3%, which on the surface seems good, but then you scratch your head and you think, 288,000 is good, but it's not enough to drop it 0.4 of a point. And deeper in the report, you find out that 806,000 people dropped out of the labor force. So while more jobs are being added, at the same time, more people dropping out at more than double the rate, almost triple the rate of those who are able to find employment.
In righty Twitter world and blog comment sections and stuff like that, there's, you know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they just make all that stuff up. They don't make all that stuff up, but I think there are more oddities cropping up week by month by month that make you wonder if they're measuring what they really think they're measuring and whether the tools they use for measure it. Remember, this is just really a giant survey. They just call up a big chunk of people, a big chunk of companies and say, all right, what are you finding? What's your circumstance? Maybe it's not quite, you know, representing those things, because the idea of making 288,000 jobs in the past month, that's wonderful news if true. It seems, you know, really high, you know, kind of high, but maybe we do see a pickup in spring. Greg, how do you lose 800,000 people from the workforce in 1 month? That's like a decent sized city that just dropped out, no longer working, no longer looking for work. If Putin had conquered a portion of the United States, okay, well, that's the figure. You know, he took Vermont, and that's what happened. That's why we don't have any people there. But, you know, and obviously some of this is baby boomer retiring. Some of this is people, I mean, you might say, they can go back to school, or they can join the Peace Corps. There are various things you can do that take yourself out of that figure. But to see it on this huge scale just seems very, very odd. And when the, you know, drop, you know, you're going to see the administration taking another victory lap saying, oh, it's 6.3%. It's great. I would just remind them that for the entirety of the Bush years, the unemployment rate was between 4 and 6. So here we are, 5.5 years into Obama's presidency, and we're still waiting to see Bush-era levels of unemployment. But the most that's driven by people dropping out of the workforce, and you're kind of wondering what these people are doing and how they're supporting themselves. Obviously, public assistance is part of it. Retirement is some of it. But, you know, we're a country that thrives, and we have lots of people working. And while that 288 figure is pretty good, we'll see if it gets revised at all, the number of people leaving the workforce is really, really unnerving.
Yeah, definitely the case, and certainly major sobering moment when you thought there might actually be some real good news there. And while part of it is better, the 806,000 is just massive in the opposite direction. All right, back to Benghazi for the crazy martini now. And, of course, the talking points is one of the big parts of this scandal, because the White House put forth the narrative that the video, the anti-Islam YouTube video, was to blame for the attacks in Benghazi. Well, last night on Special Report on the Fox News Channel, Brett Baer welcomed in Tommy Vitor, former spokesman for the National Security Council, who was part of the team that put together the talking points in the wake of the Benghazi attacks. And so Brett Baer is walking him through the timeline, and this is what happened.
At 6:21, the White House, you,
me,
add a line about the administration warning of September 10th of social media reports calling for demonstrations. True?
I believe so.
Did you also change attacks to demonstrations in the talking points?
Maybe. I don't really remember.
You don't remember?
Dude, this was like 2 years ago. We're still talking about the most mundane process.
It is the thing that everybody is talking about.
We're talking about the process of editing talking points. That's what bureaucrats do all day long.
So Vitor goes on to say that the acting CIA chief, Mike Morrell, is actually the one who ultimately changed that particular part of the talking points. Jim, dude, the fact that somebody like Tommy Vitor was that close to making major policy decisions and talking points is a little bit frightening.
I have three things to say here, Greg. The first is That's really kind of intriguing, since Morrell was the guy who said under oath to Congress he didn't know where Rice got the idea that it was from the video, which by itself is unnerving. But now, you know, Viator is saying that Rono was Morrell all along. So there's a possibility that somebody is lying under oath here, or Viator is just lying right now in front to Brett Baer. Two, a lot of people are really giving him a lot of grief over this morning. We should acknowledge the strong points in his record. Greg, I really love Tommy Viator when he did that movie about losing his car with Ashton Kutcher. Really, you know, really good, funny stuff. As I noted on Twitter, dude, this was like 2 years ago. It's not just the dude, it's the like, you know, that's the other thing, which kind of, you know, it's not just, you know, there's, you know, the two Valley girl or, you know, surfer guy colloquialisms stuck into that sentence there. As I said, this sounds like a line of dialogue from an early 90s bad cable movie in which Pauly Shore accidentally becomes president of the United States. But I really feel the way we can best shed light on this subject and kind of the intellectual candle power being brought to bear at these serious foreign policy crises. Greg, I'm gonna try with you to reenact a vital debate scene in the cinematic masterpiece Basketball by the Zucker Brothers. And if you haven't seen the scene, I think you can follow it along. I'll begin with my third major point in this argument, Greg, and I hope you're prepared to respond. It is simply, dude. Ah, it's a good point. There you go. That I understand. That actually comes from a transcript of what was going on in the White House Situation Room on the night of Benghazi. So we're in the very best of hands, America. Have a good weekend.
Oh, who knew Pajama Boy had a high-ranking job in the administration? Jim, have a great weekend.
Dude, Will. Jim, some gnarly waves out there, brother.
Oh, they're totally rad. All right, Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And please join us again on Monday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch. Have a great weekend, everyone.